Chapter 11. Beautiful Things. The firebrand glow on the walls dies like a fading sunset as footsteps whisper away into faintness. The smoke lingers, but eventually its particles dissipate into the inky blackness. Winters upon winters pass, the years marked by rumbling heartbeats of hibernating bears. The cave is in stasis, warmed only by their slow breaths. Thickly furred generations wear the ground into bowl-shaped nests, while all around calcite-loaded water trickles, drips, flows. Micro-thick layers rise into leathery drapes, frozen mid-billow. Pale fingers stretch upwards over tens of millennia. Sometimes the bears wake early. Confused in the dark, they wander towards a deep chamber. Questing ursine snouts touch hard, cold rock bones, snapped and lying in long walls. Many bears, many times, raise their heads, scenting water, clay, cave. Once, long ago, some caught lingering traces of charred bone. But in the blackness, their wide eyes are blind to the strange edifice in front of them. Yet more years crawl by before a muffled crashing marks a rockfall sealing the cave. Dusty air billows into the chamber, disturbs dead, flat pools on the floor. Without illumination, the trembling water contains no shivering reflections of the carefully constructed stalagmite rings. They wait. To find the strangest Neanderthal site, you must go to the Aveyron Valley, a less visited region of southwest France than the Périgord. Twisting for kilometres through deep gorges, the river passes a hill near the town of Bruniquel that hides a secret. Deep inside a cave, something wondrous lies, utterly bizarre and old, even for Neanderthals. In 1990, when cavers broke through massive rooffall debris, they had no idea of what lay more than 300 metres or 330 yards inside. Stalagmites were bestrewn across the floor of a broad chamber, but what at first seemed random resolved into two roughly circular forms. After initially being radiocarbon dated to older than 47,000 years, it remained an intriguing anomaly until a new project began in 2013. Then the real revelation came. A large series of dates using the uranium series method showed unequivocally that this subterranean structure was made over 174,000 years ago. Instantly, Bruniquel became one of the most important Neanderthal sites ever found. Meticulous study found complexity at every level. Over 400 stalagmites had been snapped off, and from among the broken pieces, Neanderthals had selected wide, straight mid-portions, obviously with particular sizes in mind. By aligning their spelio facts, they formed two rings on the chamber floor. The largest is more than 6 by 4 metres, or 6.6 by 4.4 yards, and contains two small speleofact piles, with another two heaps placed externally at either end. A second, smaller but more circular ring is set to one side. While the heaps of broken columns recall a classical ruin, closer inspection shows this isn't a random jumble, but a built construction. Each ring is made from up to four layers, some sections buttressed with vertical pieces, and one zone features five elongated speleofacts stood up side by side. The intricacy goes beyond support and into architecture. Tucked in behind the five sentinels is a doubly poised creation, a flat plate balanced on a cylinder, itself holding up other pieces. This is already a place that goes beyond unique into jaw-dropping. But there's other things going on. Burning was identified at multiple points along the rings and within the small piles. In fact, about a quarter of all the speleofacts have been exposed to fire. And in some cases, it seems as if blazes were lit on top of the structures. Some fragments of burned bone are also visible, the largest of which, inside one of the piles, may be bare. Both the speleofact constructions and the burning event that charred that bone piece took place between 178.6 and 174.4 thousand years ago, and with available dating resolution, are basically contemporary. No possible natural process could explain the rings. Bears were hibernating in the cave system and can sometimes damage stalagmites while stumbling in the dark. But not only are the rings much larger than any bear nests, this wouldn't explain built walls. The mystery of Bruniquel only deepens the more one thinks about it. It's not a place for staying like other caves or rock shelters. So deep into the hillside, continuous illumination would have been needed. That means not only a Herculean effort in terms of fuel collection, but also choking smoke. Moreover, building fires on top of the ring walls makes little sense if this was a structure for living inside. Flowstone covers most of the floor between the structures, but there's no visible lithic or butchery detritus. And constructing the rings was no casual feat. The total weight of arranged speleofacts is over 2 tons. And even assuming multiple individuals were involved, it must have taken at least 6 to 7 straight hours to build. Why would Neanderthals spend hours, maybe days, deep underground, breaking and hefting heavy rock, piling, balancing and burning them? Laser-scanned overhead images best communicate the utter weirdness of this place. The harvested stalagmite stumps rise up like some sunken forest through the flowstone floor, and the rings unmistakably radiate purpose. But exactly what is baffling? The remote chamber is one of the most spacious parts of the cave, but is somewhat secret, located where walls pinch inwards and turn, before a large corridor continues for at least 100 metres or 110 yards. The burned areas are a further mystery. Presumably some were to provide lighting, but intense heat damage on some of the speleofacts hints that it might also have helped in fracturing them. And were the bones fuel, food, or something else? Most intriguingly, magnetic analysis, which can detect evidence of ancient heating, showed 2 things. Other hearths may lie beneath the flowstone floor, and some of those burn zones have double cores. This latter feature most likely means hearths were relit, strongly suggesting Neanderthals made return visits. Steeped in eldritch vibes, the significance of Bruniquel's ring chamber is enormous, the only monumental construction known to have been made by Neanderthals. Yet on further consideration, everything about it echoes the processes of fragmentation and accumulation central to so many other aspects of Neanderthal life. Exploring deep inside the Earth's body, perhaps the festooned flowstone and thickets of knobbly white protrusions looked like flesh, guts and bones. A stone carcass to be broken apart and put back anew. Mind in the body. Bruniquel laughs in the face of austere, survival-only explanations for Neanderthal behaviour. It surely was made by thinking, but also feeling minds. Emotions, in reality, underlie virtually everything people do, no matter if logical explanations also exist. All human cultures also have a desire for or transcendence, whether expressed through painting cave walls, raising cathedrals, singing millennia-old sacred songs, or climbing among airy mountain peaks. This urge is common to all peoples across time and space. Musing about minds from 50 or 100 millennia ago is of course fraught with pitfalls, not least because even with living people, resolving the miracle of consciousness is like reaching for a shimmering mirage. Until we can trace how our own neurons and sensory systems mesh together to produce perceptions and emotions, doing so for Neanderthals remains out of reach. But that's not to say we can't make well-informed guesses. As with our fellow great apes, their existence would be founded on emotion. Fear, pleasure, pain, excitement, and desire would have flooded through every Neanderthal that ever lived. Hearts hammering, guts clenching, loins tightening. But more tantalizingly, some apes seem to express more complex shades of feeling. In particular, chimpanzees have been observed responding with primal outbursts to natural phenomena, like heavy rain or waterfalls. Ascribing any level of formal spirituality to Neanderthals would go far beyond the archaeological evidence. But they too encountered all of life's sensory marvels. Perhaps as photons from a salmon belly sunset saturated their retinas, or the groaning song of a mile-high glacier filled their ears, Neanderthals' brains translated this to something like awe. Feeling wonder inside oneself is one thing. Being able to share an awe-inspiring or transcendent experience is much more powerful. For a metaphysical life to emerge, language is key because it allows emotion and meaning to become crystallized. Whether Neanderthals had any kind of language is, of course, one of the most enduring questions about them. What does the most up-to-date brain science tell us? Compared to the entire Homo lineage, Neanderthals' brains are, like ours, enormous. Despite being less bulbous, the average capacity of their skulls was a bit greater. That means more neurons, the connective plumbing between different areas, but it's about more than bulk. What matters more is organisation. Neanderthals' flatter foreheads had less room for the frontal cortex area, intimately connected to complex thought processes like memory and language. And they also had smaller cerebelli, another area involved in concentration, communication, and language. In living people, reduced cerebelli does seem to indicate poorer skills, and in Neanderthals, the connections to other language-related zones were also smaller. However, as with debates in Chapter 3 over possible cognitive trade-offs from their larger visual system, it's extremely hard to be sure whether in Neanderthal size truly equates to proficiency, or if their grey matter compensated in other ways. Notably, our own brains have slightly shrunk since early Homo sapiens, with no apparent shriveling in cognitive capacity. When we add in bodies and archaeology, the odds start to stack up in favour of some spoken communication. While there's been a lot of back and forth debates over this, today it appears that Neanderthal vocal cords could make pretty much the same range of sounds as ours. There were perhaps some subtle differences in vowels, including R. But their breath control wasn't appreciably poorer, giving them the ability to utter lengthy sound combinations. Moreover, though their inner ear shape was slightly different, it was similarly finely tuned to sound frequencies generated by speech. If this anatomy in humans is regarded as specialised for language, then Neanderthals cannot have been so different. The same thing is true of brains. In your head right now, Broca's area is busy understanding the words on this page. and it was also well developed in Neanderthals, with neurons that would have lit up as well-practiced hands napped a Levallois core, or even when children watched elders butchering. Complementary evidence for language comes from the fact Neanderthals seem to have had similar rates of handedness. Tooth micro-scratches and patterns of napping on cores confirm they were dominated by right-handers. And this is also reflected in asymmetry in one side of their brains. But when we zoom in further to genetics, things get increasingly thorny. The FOXP2 gene is a case in point. Humans have a mutation that changed just two amino acids from those in other animals, whether chimpanzees or platypi. FOXP2 is definitely involved with cognitive and physical language capacity in living people. But it isn't the language gene, no such thing exists. Rather, it affects multiple aspects of brain and central nervous system development. When it was confirmed that Neanderthals had the same FOXP2 gene as us, it was taken as strong evidence that they could talk. But another, subtler alteration has been found that happened after we had split from them. It's tiny, a single protein. And though the precise anatomical effect isn't yet known, experiments show it does change how FOXP2 itself works. Small chinks of light like this are fascinating, but we're far from mapping out any kind of genetic recipe where adding this or taking away that would make Neanderthals loquacious or laconic. Taking everything on balance, it's very likely Neanderthals spoke in some form. But about what? Numerous animals call attention to things, and some primate vocalising even contains contextual information, the type of predator and where it's located. But more subtle communication, such as describing things that already happened or have not yet come to pass, requires understanding of order and time. Certainly, there's ample archaeological evidence that Neanderthals were organised in terms of who went where and when. So some level of discussion for collaborative activity is probable. Could they tell stories? The tales we spin weave together past, future, and even magical creations. It's possible to argue that all of these concepts are manifest in composite tools. Syntax-like objects made of ordered parts from numerous places added at different times. In making and using these, Neanderthal imaginations moved far beyond the here and now, and with birch tar even included a supernatural substance. Perhaps the most crucial requirement for storytelling, whatever the subject, is the desire for connection. Standing above a glass still pool, there's no doubt Neanderthals recognise their reflection, as do dolphins, elephants, and apes. With this ability comes empathy and understanding of others' points of view, and all combine in shared systems of meaning. Language is effectively commonly understood sound symbols, and even captive apes can learn to express simple ideas, such as give ball, using graphical symbols. But they never use this skill to casually chat, despite this defining everyday human communication. Neanderthals very likely used symbols too, at least including gestures, in addition to learning animal tracks, essentially graphic signs for each species. They certainly laughed, probably joked, and may have memorised chronicles of a sort. And returning to the Brunichel rings, we're confronted by a creation redolent of deeper meanings. An odd coincidence, just around the river bend from Brunichel, is the Montastruc rock shelter. A couple of years after Faulkner witnessed the La Madeleine mammoth engraving in 1864, Montastruc produced more stunning Upper Paleolithic objets d'art, including two carved reindeer, probably swimming. The last chapter explored how these creatures were central to some Neanderthals' lives, and they must also have seen them crossing rivers. Yet, in the 150-odd years since the Montastruc carving's discovery, no comparable artefacts have emerged from any of their sites. On the other hand, the past three decades have seen an explosion in archaeological evidence beyond Brunecke for symbolic aspects to Neanderthal life. As with every human culture, their quotidian experience would have been imbued with associations. Hearing whinnies implied horse, while smelling smoke meant fire. But did more abstract, symbolic significances also exist, such as red equals blood? Primate visual systems are primed for vivid colours, particularly reds, as well as lustre. Bright, shiny things catch archaeologists' attention too, and that snap of recognition can preserve a precious remnant from oblivion. Did Neanderthals also have a magpie lust for shine and glitter? When things with those qualities but no obvious practical function are found, it's hard not to instinctively assume an aesthetic motivation for their presence. The simplest cases are maniports, meaning carried in by hand. They're always rare compared to bones or lithics, but known across the Neanderthal world. Examples include a quartz crystal at Abri des Pêcheurs, southeast France, or a fossil shell at Pêche de l'Azay 1. Shiny things snag the gaze, while fossils mimic living things in an unexpected substance, so we must assume Neanderthals' curiosity was piqued. They also picked up things with unusual tactile qualities, such as pumice stones found at some Italian sites. And these curiosities were sometimes also moved long distances. The Pêche de l'Azay 1 fossil was carried at least 30 kilometres or 20 miles, and given everything hefted by hand must have been thought important, this was no thoughtless choice. Were such things symbolic? Bowerbirds instinctively collect natural gewgaws and create exhibitions of bling, but they're aimed at attracting females, a kind of peacock's tail, and there isn't the same impression of material curiosity. Yet we can't assume that our own standards of meaning were always shared by Neanderthals. The beauty of rock crystal lithics at Abri des Merveilles, southwest France, may suggest they were significant objects, but in fact Neanderthals sourced and napped them exactly like other rocks. What's needed to infer something deeper is special treatment or repeated associations and patterns in behaviour. Chuari Baroshten Cave in the southern Carpathians might have something along these lines. Excavations in the past 20 years uncovered a hard, ball-like object, just large enough to fill your hand, yet remarkably dense. Scanning revealed it to be mineral geode, possibly opal. Where Neanderthals found it is unknown. The local river passes through volcanic regions where geodes might be found, but it's so heavy that it's not likely to have rolled far downstream. Already an intriguing object, when surface carbonate crust was removed, tiny specks of colour emerged. High magnification showed red ochre patches, overlain by an unidentified black material. The geode is an anomaly at Chuari Borostyny, but use of pigment isn't. From an overlying level, red and black residues were found inside eight bowl-shaped sections of stalagmite and calcite crust. They're very small, mostly about 6 centimetres or 2.4 inches across, and it's not clear if Neanderthals shaped them or simply used already broken pieces. But they appear very much like containers. What the pigment was used for can only be imagined. But Shuare Boroshtanya's significance lies in showing that Neanderthals, over considerable periods of time, were interested in applying colour to unusual things. That, fundamentally, is a definition of art. Colour. Evidence for Neanderthal symbolism has seen a pigment boom in the past decade. The odd bit here and there was noted since the earlier 20th century, but recent analytical advances have identified pigments at more than 70 sites just in Europe. As well as red and yellow minerals, Neanderthals were collecting and using various black substances. But what for? Colour is central to visual displays for social communication across the animal world. But before we get carried away, practical applications are also possible. Minerals can be used for sunscreen, insect repellent, hair management, or even antiseptics. Ochres in particular can be used in hide working or as hafting glue additives, while as mentioned in Chapter 9, black manganese may be useful in firelighting. There's certainly plenty of evidence pigments were used. Many nodules have wear traces, sometimes from being rubbed on soft things or due to scraping in a way that produced richly coloured powder. Astonishingly, we know that already between 250 and 200,000 years ago, Neanderthals were making liquid red ochre. Minute analysis of red-stained sediments from the open-air locale of Maastricht, Belvedere, Netherlands, showed they were ochre splashes. The nearest source was between 40 and 80 kilometres, or 25 and 50 miles away. But it's not known if this was carried as a block or already powdered. Presumably, it was mixed on site, either with a container or by mouth. Some older Central African ochre quarries exist, presumably worked by early Homo sapiens. But Maastricht Belvedere is the oldest known use of pigment. For Neanderthals, as time goes by, pigment gets much more common in the archaeological record. Most impressive in levels around 60,000 years ago at Pêche de Lazay 1, there are some 500 pieces of black manganese, at least half bearing varied wear traces. And while there are far fewer pieces overall just next door in Pêche de Lazay 4, the fact that they extend through 9 levels points to continuity in behaviour. Concarneau is also remarkable for long-term pigment use, with around 70 blocks through 16 layers. But here the colours and uses shift, and they appear linked to different techno-complexes. Keener layers mostly have grey-black minerals, with wear ranging from scraping to grinding. One even seems to have been used as a retoucher. After this, mineral use becomes rarer, but unworn red pieces appear. Then, during a phase of discoid assemblages, more reds, browns, and yellows turn up, but they're different chemically and must have come from other sources. In some southwest French sites, it's possible to make out that, once again, Neanderthals were focusing on quality. They must either have been systematically searching large areas for the richest manganese minerals or selecting the best pieces from individual sources. Intriguing new research at Skladina, Belgium, shows that in some situations, colour was the key factor. Sometime after 45,000 years ago, Neanderthals there had brought more than 50 flat, dark grey pieces of siltstone at least 40 kilometres or 25 miles over a high plateau from another river basin. No use traces were visible, but the graphite-rich stone has no pyrotechnic value and is extremely soft, and when rubbed leaves clear black marks. Neanderthals' choosiness and willingness to systematically collect pigment tells us that whatever their use, it was far from thoughtless. Most interestingly, some sites indicate connections between pigment and shells. Cueva de los Aviones sits beneath an 18th century fort at the port of Cartagena, southern Spain. Remnant deposits by the old cave mouth contain hundreds of shells, probably collected for food, but beneath cemented sediment on two dog cockles, red ochre was visible. Small holes near the tips of both shells have been claimed as artificial, but whether or not that's the case, they're not anomalies. A horse bone and three other shells, thorny oysters, also bear pigment, and remarkably, they show Neanderthals were colour mixing. Analysis showed that the recipe contained hematite, goethite, black carbon, probably charcoal or burned bone, limestone, and sparkly pyrite. The Cueva de los Aviones discovery stimulated speculative headlines about Neanderthal cosmetics and jewellery. But even if that's not true, it's a hugely important find. Despite their small size, the shells could have been containers, though the mixing must have been in something else. These Neanderthals were experimenting, combining substances to create different visual effects. Moreover, they had to have obtained the ingredients from different rock outcrops, the closest at least several kilometres away. Recent dating of flowstone overlying the Cueva de los Aviones sequence gave an unexpectedly ancient result of 115,000 years, far in excess of radiocarbon dates. If confirmed, this would push complex pigment use well back in Neanderthal history. Elsewhere, Neanderthals were applying pigment to shells that definitely weren't food waste. Microscopic analysis of a tiny fossil mollusk from the discoid level A9 at Fomane Cave identified pure red ochre inside surface micropits, but only on the outside. What's more, the pigment was sourced up to 20 kilometres or 13 miles away, while the nearest rocks with such fossils are located over 100 kilometres or 60 miles from Fomane. Combined, the fossil shell and pigment are more than two unusual materials. They have a distinctive new meaning, a specialness. Tantalisingly, researchers could also see where, on the shell's lip, where something soft but abrasive had repeatedly rubbed sideways, suggesting that it had once been strung or attached by thong or thread. This was an aesthetic artefact, the colour meant to be seen. This single object sparks a cascade of scenarios, all imagined but archaeologically supported. Sometime around 46,000 years ago, a Neanderthal noticed stone shells eroding from limestone and picked one up. She carried this tiny piece from place to place, kept it so long its surface became polished. Her fingers pressed in special red colour, leaving a stain on her skin. Eventually, one day it dropped from its usual place, folded in or tied onto leather, and, unknowingly or not, she left it behind in the mountains. Had the shell been excavated from an early Homo sapiens site, seeing this as symbolic behaviour would be uncontroversial. Whether it had practical as well as aesthetic use, it was unarguably precious. Pigment was probably a lot more common among Neanderthals than the tiny surviving traces would lead us to believe. They may also have used it on canvases rather larger than shells. In 2018, new dates from three Iberian caves full of Upper Paleolithic paintings were announced. Each sample covered, or was next to, red pigments, and they were so old that nobody but Neanderthals are known to have been around. At Ardila's Cave, Malaga, various stalagmites and flowstone formations in different areas of the cave have obvious red daubings, sometimes only visible as a layer inside broken formations, gradually hidden over time. The new dates seemed to fall into two phases, the younger of which had minimum ages of 36,000 years ago, and so could be Homo sapiens. But a handful of older dates had minimum ages before 45,000 years ago, and one was an astonishing 65,000 years ago. By itself, Ardalus would already be hugely important, but the other sites were truly unexpected. At La Pasiega, Cantabria, one sampled area of millimetre-thick crust covering a vertical red line pointed to it being painted well before 60,000 years ago. The third locale was different again. Maltravieso in central Iberia was already well known for hand stencils made by spraying or daubing paint, a motif found in numerous other Upper Paleolithic decorated caves. On the ceiling of an isolated area, a faint example was revealed by photographic processing, and when adjacent calcite samples were dated, the oldest came out at more than 54,000 years old. While the Königsauer birch tar and the Le Rosel sands bear accidental prints, if genuine, this would be the first intentional image of a Neanderthal hand. A spine-tingling thought. These discoveries have set ablaze debates over whether Neanderthals really were the artists. Taken at face value, the chronology should place this beyond doubt. More time lies between some of the paintings and any sign of Homo sapiens in the region than between you and the end of the last ice age. But to many, the dates are literally incredible, in the sense of being highly unlikely. They're extreme anomalies, even for other calcite samples in these locations. They're extreme anomalies, even for other calcite samples in these locales. The same caves have panel after panel of art that, based on abundant, independent evidence, are believed to be Upper Paleolithic. The line at La Pasiega is part of a larger grid-like design surrounded by other images, all of which have overlying crust dates younger than 12,000 years ago. And in the entire cave, no other dates are older than 22,000 years ago. The situation is similar at Maltravieso. Caves are extremely tricky in geochemical terms, and in the absence of an explanation for why closely adjacent crusts formed at dramatically different times, the suspicion is of contamination. Whether or not the dates in the Iberian sites are eventually verified, the implications for Neanderthal aesthetics that they represent may not in fact be so revolutionary. A painted line on a cave wall is not so different to slicing lines through animal skins, across bone or wood. And the hand negative, while undoubtedly striking, might not be a massive cognitive leap for hominins who probably already understood the idea of representation. Animal footprints are effectively symbols, and even simple tracking requires an idealized form to be kept in mind. Handprints, then, are human tracks, and visible in daily life, whether butchery bloodied or marked by soot. Moreover, a little-known site in France may provide independent evidence that Neanderthals elsewhere were marking and painting walls. In 1846, 2 years before the Forbes Quarry skull was found, caves near the small town of Longeuil, near Tours, were uncovered, probably by railway workers mining cliff-front deposits. One, known as La Roche-Gotard, was largely emptied out by 1913. But reinvestigations since 2008 discovered small patches of red pigment on the walls, along with finger marks dragged through soft, silty deposits. Geological study and archives from the early 20th century excavation suggest that the cave was filled to within 20 to 50 centimetres or 8 to 20 inches of the ceiling, then sealed off by 39,000 to 35,000 years ago. Only Middle Paleolithic lithics were found, along with fauna dating to between 50 and 44,000 years ago, all of which implies that the pigment and finger flutings are the work of Neanderthals. Certainly this site is far from ideal in terms of direct dating and context. But the use of pigment would also not be out of place with what we see elsewhere. Most interestingly, the largest spot is placed on an unusual sinuous chert formation, emerging from the wall like entrails of the rock itself. And the co-presence of pigment and fingerwork connects to another realm of Neanderthal material engagement, engraved markings. Markings. Neanderthals spent much of their time incising, scraping, and creating markings on different substances, often as a byproduct of other activities. Think of butchery cut marks. But increasingly, it's also looking like sometimes the marking was itself the point. And occasionally they even engraved pigment itself. In the same level at Les Bossins, where large stones had been brought in, over 80 small reddish-orange nodules were found. Using 21st century analytical methods, including the world's only dedicated heritage particle accelerator, researchers showed that rather than local iron-rich formations, Neanderthals had used minerals brought in from across the Luang River. Available deposits range between 5 to 40 kilometres or 3 to 25 miles away, but only purer concretions had been selected, and most unusually among varied wear traces, including pounding, scraping, and smoothing. Some nodules had been incised with deep parallel lines. They're different to scratches that would produce powder and occur in groups of 2 to 4. All the pigments are found within 10 metres or 30 feet of each other, some even closely packed with lithics, bone fragments and burned materials into 2 small depressions, probably intentionally hollowed out. Almost identical objects, when found at early Homo sapiens sites, are interpreted as graphic forms and very likely symbolic. These are rare things in Neanderthal sites. However, there may be one other among the manganese pieces at Pêche de Lazay 1. But scored marks are known on many other materials. Scratches on cortex, the chalky outer skin of some lithic artefacts, can be accidentally caused. On the other hand, lines and pits on objects in some Italian sites must have been made before the core was napped, which is hard to explain except possibly as a way to produce white powder. Indeed, among the red and black pigment at Comgrenal, Neanderthals also brought in 4 pieces of chalk. But a small engraving on cortex from Kikoba in the eastern Crimean mountains seems different. Microscopic analysis found that 13 roughly parallel lines were probably created with the same tool. 3 are noticeably shorter and distinctly shaped, however, marking a change in desired form, another engraver, or perhaps a change of tool. The cortex wouldn't have produced powder, and crucially, the lines all begin and end inside the area of the artefact. Whatever the motivation, it's difficult to see this other than as an aesthetic project, rapidly executed, but with focused attention. More commonly incised than minerals or stones are animal remains. While microscopic scrutiny has winnowed out various examples as butchery or natural markings, a number of others don't have such explanations. The most ancient is an elephant bone from Bilsingsleben, Germany, engraved with two sets of parallel lines at different angles. At around 350,000 years ago, it's not much older than Schöningen and was likely made by early Neanderthals. But following this, there are few other objects for the next 150,000 years. In contrast, three new finds have recently emerged, all dating between 90,000 and 45,000 years ago, and all involve unusual species. At Peshtavina Cave, Serbia, 10 fan-shaped lines on a probable old bear neck bone have no feasible origin during butchering. Instead, they're more like the Kikoba cortex lines, terminating before the bone's edge, like a design within the space. The other two artifacts are small but remarkable for their symbolic potential. One was made on a broken, already old hyena bone from Les Pradelles, and the other on a raven's wing from Zaskalnia 6 rock shelter in the Crimean Mountains. Despite being widely separated geographically and in the method with which they were created, they share tiny sequences of evenly spaced incisions. Five out of the seven notches on the Zaskalnia bone are deeply sawn, but two that appear to have been added in between are far shallower cuts, probably using the same tool but held differently. Without those two additions, the overall effect would have been perceived as uneven. They are about aesthetics. The Pradelles hyena bone is even more exceptional. On a surface just 5 centimetres or 2 inches long, a Neanderthal made 9 parallel incisions, with extremely similar shapes, all cut in the same direction with a single tool, and probably at the same time, the final mark looks to have been crammed into the narrowing width of the bone, as if its inclusion was more important than the overall appearance. Then it gets weird. Near the third line's base is a further set of 8 minuscule nicks in 2 pairs, each set intersecting at their origin points. Just 2 to 3 millimetres, or 0.08 to 0.01 inch long. They're nonetheless regular, all made with the same tool, though not necessarily that which cut the larger series, and certainly not natural. Both the Zaskalnia and Les Pradelles markings go beyond most other Neanderthal engravings by showing regularity and structure. The raven bone hints at a desire to maintain a pattern, which might include paired markings. But the Les Pradelles bone is probably the first strong case for Neanderthal notation, counting things of equivalent value, with the small secondary marks somehow adding to or altering the meaning of the main series. Neanderthal mathematicians are far from implied, but like many other animals, they must have had an innate ability to precisely recognise small quantities. This is more instant comprehension than counting, and would have been complemented by a general understanding of more versus less when dealing with larger quantities of things. It's believed that human skill with numbers evolved from these capacities, amply demonstrated in apes, and the process probably began early in the hominin lineage with small numbers. That's just what we see in the groupings of marks on the Les Pradelles and Zaskalnia bones. Rather than an ordinal 1 to 100 understanding, it's possible Neanderthal numeracy was based in sets, like tally systems. Fascinatingly, in children, innate number recognition is present across the senses. Hearing, as well as looking, can evaluate quantity. It's therefore possible that, given the diminutive size of the secondary incisions on the Les Pradelles bone, they were meant to be experienced through touch. Imagining Neanderthal fingertips rubbing across them raises the fact that all the engraved objects discussed so far were easily carried, perhaps even shared. But there's one exception. Within Gorham's Cave, Gibraltar, 13 intersecting lines were deeply etched, sometime well before 40,000 years ago, onto a raised section of the stone floor. They form a rough grid pattern, dubbed by the media as the hashtag, but would have taken far longer to produce than the average tweet. Experiments suggest that somewhere between 200 and 300 gougings were needed, and they were produced in a particular sequence. First, two deep horizontal lines were done, followed by five verticals, all cut in the same direction. Next, one of the horizontals was deepened, and finally, more verticals were added. Again, the impression is of sets and ordering. The weight of evidence from more and more cases of pigment use and mark-making is increasingly leading even sceptics to accept that Neanderthals had an aesthetic, symbolic element to their lives. Nobody will argue that the Neanderthal artistic oeuvre, even assuming the Maltravieso hand or Pasiega line dates, are correct, is the same as that created by cultures across the globe today. But did they have art? Our species likes to reserve such tendencies as a self-defining trait. But even captive chimpanzees, when materials and the idea of painting are supplied, enjoy colouring and marking surfaces. Ape works, in fact, show startling parallels with some of what Neanderthals did. They generally stay within the canvas and show appreciation for symmetry or balance. Marks are made at roughly equal distances and gaps filled or paintings lengthened to fill spaces. Chimps also revisit particular zones in a single session, overwriting existing marks with new ones. And some are keen on mixing colours. A personal style even emerges, with some chimps favouring different forms, including radiating, fan-like lines. Most intriguingly, though intensely focused while painting, they often appear less interested in the resulting image. For them, the aesthetic, in its original sense of being perceived and enjoyed, lies in the creation, not the end product. Art as the process of bodily and sensory engagement with materials might be unfamiliar to classical Western sensibilities, but plenty of human cultures through time understand its transcendent power. Feather and claw. The Zaskalnaya raven that once soared over the Crimean mountains connects us to another recently recognised realm of potential symbolic behaviour. What Neanderthals were doing with birds. As we saw in Chapter 8, there's plenty of evidence that they were eating them. The Zaskalnaya bone also bears marks from removing meat. However, there are hints that things sometimes went beyond mere survival. In particular, in a number of sites, wings are more common than might be expected. They're far from the meatiest parts, yet often have the most cut marks and come from unusual species. In the raven lair at Zaskalnaya, there's also a bone from a grey heron's wing. Think back to the intriguing spatial separation of waste from processing wings in level A9 at Fumane Cave, the same layer as the ochred shell. While the presence of other body parts from chough and grouse point to use as food, raptors are only represented by butchered wings. Whether lammergeier, greater spotted eagle, black vulture, or even diminutive merlin. Clearly, through at least a century, Neanderthals here were interested in these creatures and their wings, and this seems to have continued to some extent in later layers. But bird feet may also have been a focus of attention. Again, at Zaskalnaya, in the raven's lair, the end toe bone from an eagle was found, while the older level A12 at Fumane produced an eagle claw. And even the grouse from level A9 there seemed to show an excess of foot bones despite being hunted and brought back whole from the nearby pine forest. Systematic studies have found a similar pattern of butchered raptor feet or claws, especially eagles, across a number of locales dating between 100,000 and 45,000 years ago in France and Italy. In some places, there's more than one. At the collapsed cave site of Les Fieux, a few kilometres south of the Dordogne Valley, 20 bones from large raptors from multiple layers are almost all talons. Most tantalisingly, two of the biggest white-tailed eagle toe bones from the same layer were missing the talons, perhaps having been taken elsewhere. Theories that talons were adornments existed, but became amplified after 8 butchered white-tailed eagle talons from Crapina were proposed to be a necklace. Along with a toe bone, microscopic examination found smoothed-over cut marks and small, bright areas that resemble contact polish from rubbing against both soft and hard things. No other bones there have similar wear patterns. And while various birds are also part of the Crapina fauna, it's only eagles, 3 or maybe 4 birds, that were butchered. However, proposals that the talons were originally strung together are difficult to support, since even though they all come from the uppermost level, it's a thick deposit and there's no proof they were associated with each other, much less as a single impressive object. A recent finding of collagen fibres preserved beneath a thin silica film on one of the talons is intriguing, but it's not enough to claim as the binding for a claw collar. Although these discoveries fired reconstruction artists' imaginations to produce images of Neanderthals sporting feathers and claws, can we be sure there isn't a practical purpose? Raptors and birds from the crow family were absolutely on the menu in some contexts, but the preponderance of talons does stand out. Sometimes they're the only butchered bird bone. And careful analysis of traces from jointing, skinning, and scraping wings and feet implies that this wasn't always to do with getting flesh or marrow, especially for small species like chough. It's not hard to imagine uses for entire wings or even feet and talons, from brushes to hunting camouflage to piercing tools. But none really convince given the effort required. An often overlooked resource, however, are tendons. These stringy things can be used for all manner of purposes. And we know Neanderthals were systematically extracting them from hunted mammals like reindeer. In big raptors, they're particularly large and strong. But experimental research showed that in many sites, Neanderthals were removing claws from behind, and in the process cutting right through the tendons, while also apparently avoiding the shiny talon itself. This duality is also seen with wings. Sometimes it's probably about getting out tendons, but often the butchery marks point to Neanderthals actually seeking the primary flight feathers. Unlike fluffy down, these have no thermal properties, and neither would they be of any use as flight aids on spears of the size typically used. Instead, it does look as if aesthetics or a symbolic interest in some cases was part of, or the primary motivation. Feathers have been used for social purposes in societies across the world, and bejewelled grousefoot brooches are still worn by some in the shooting community or for pinning Scottish kilts. Is it so strange Neanderthals might have collected bird parts for beauty or other associations? Colour is one of the key things that makes feathers attractive, and it's notable that many species Neanderthals were interested in had distinctively dark plumage. Blacks, dark browns, greys, even talons and claws are typically black and glossy. Red is present too. The sooty feathers of male black grouse are set off by red topknots, while chough combines shiny black plumage with red or yellow bills, red feet and black claws. Significantly, in 2020, pigment was identified on the same talon at Crapina as the collagen fibre. And it's another mixed recipe. Red and yellow minerals, charcoal and clay. This association strongly suggests that in some places, bird parts were part of the Neanderthal aesthetic palette. But why these animals? Many of the species that seem to have received special treatment, like birds of prey or the crow family, were well known to Neanderthals, attending like familiars at their kill sites. Chough, in particular, may even have become habituated, since they live by caves, feed in pasture where large herbivores graze, and, as can be seen at ski resorts, are partial to human rubbish. But birds in general may have had deeper resonances. They were always within sight or hearing, and far more than for most people today, the Neanderthals' existence would have been bathed in constant birdsong. Days beginning and ending with dawn and dusk choruses were filled by seasonal song, alarm calls, or far-off cries of circling gulls or eagles. When night enveloped the land, owls echoed across valleys, nightjars comfortingly hummed, and nightingales lent glory to the dark. Yet, like us, Neanderthals were left far behind by birds' effortless flight. Perhaps they too dreamed of soaring into endless skies. More than this, aesthetics can be about altering substances and materials, creating sensual experiences, or producing visual or other effects. Sometimes these might be applied to the self. Whether or not the crepina talons really were an Eemian necklace, the possibility that some objects like shells, talons, or feathers were used for bodily adornment is real. We might also consider other animal parts like hair that leave little trace could also have been used. Missing bones at Schöningen may indicate that, as well as hides, Neanderthals took with them the swishing tails of horses. Clothing was unquestionably worn by at least some groups, and while researchers might dream of a Middle Paleolithic Ötzi, a frozen body complete with entire outfit, we must remember that Neanderthals from widely separated times and places might have been just as surprised by each other's attire as us. One thing was probably universal. Their keen interest in material properties would have featured in their clothing choices. And this might have extended beyond function to appearance. Lissoirs today aren't just used for softening hides, but also burnishing. In addition to inducing a water-repellent effect, making soggy autumn hunts more comfortable, they add a shell-like luster. Tanning to make leather isn't necessary when hide working, though it helps with preserving and waterproofing. But if you want to add colour along a pink, orange, brown spectrum, it's perfect. Incredibly, an organic residue on a small stone flake at Neumark Nord tells us Neanderthals did sometimes make leather. Chemical analysis identified high amounts of tannins, potent plant-derived substances that give colour to your cuppa and are the means by which bog bodies survive. Moreover, the tannins at Neumark Nord came from oak, which, along with chestnut, is the best tree species for tanning in an interglacial world. Once more, Neanderthals were selecting for quality. This tiny brown scrap is a peephole to wet, stained hands moving around in a large container as the bark stewed. And since tanning even small, thinner hides like fallow deer takes a week or more, this was a staying, not a walking time. While smoking will turn hides brown, tanned leather combines practical qualities and a range of brighter colours. Apparently important to Neanderthals who took the time to produce pigment mixes. Oak isn't always available, and in cooler climates, willow and birch bark or even berries work, while birch tar itself is also another option. But the evidence of bark tannin at Neumark Nord has one last interesting connection to other Neanderthal crafts that might just have been about self-adornment. As well as the Fomane shell another object bears traces of having been strung or threaded. A deep groove on the manganese retoucher at Concarneau cuts through earlier scrape marks and has a smoothed inner surface that indicates something soft within it had repeatedly rubbed. Until recently, there was no evidence that Neanderthals made any kind of cord, but that changed in 2020 with the announcement of an astonishing find at Abri du Maras. Hidden on the underside of a flake was a natural incrustation containing a 6mm or 0.2 inch long twist of plant fibre. Either made from pine or juniper bark, or potentially the roots of these species. Most surprising of all is that technologically it's a classic 3-ply thread. Three individual strands, each with fibres twisted in one direction, then all rolled together with the reverse twist. Furthermore, it's extremely fine, equivalent to threads in a hand-woven linen scarf. Even assuming possible dehydration shrinkage, something so thin has limited purposes. Hafting bindings for small lithics is possible, but thread for attaching or stringing special objects is another. Unique finds like the Abri du Maras thread are almost unbelievable, even to archaeologists, and rightfully subject to critical appraisal. But like the Neumark Nord tanned scrap, the Fomane shell, or any number of one-off flukes of preservation, they're what we have to work with. A balance must be struck between caution and not ignoring singular artifacts simply because they're rare or wondrous. Whatever Neanderthals wore, whether pigment on skin, gleaming tanned leather, cozy furs, or threaded red shells, it was always about more than function. Placing things on bodies is a powerful way to express status and identity, and observable in plenty of animals. Apes will sometimes drape themselves with things, and in particular chimpanzees like to carry parts of their prey, leading to an observation of a wild individual sporting a knotted strip of monkey skin round its neck, complete with tail. The knot might have been accidental, but the wearing wasn't. For Neanderthals, wearing clothing made from hides and furs must have mentally recalled the animals whose bodies they came from. Altering one's appearance or making oneself stand out through objects or colour also opens the door to more complicated things like communicating social affiliation to kith and kin. Belonging to social categories such as age and gender might also have been entwined with the aesthetic and symbolic things Neanderthals made or wore. Earlier chapters have already touched on how difficult it is to define gender in the past, but there do seem to be hints that Neanderthals classified anatomically or genetically by sex, lived in distinctive ways memorialised on their bones and teeth. The apparent connection between female bodies, intensive use of mouths for clamping and dragging, as well as symmetrical arm development, all point to hide working. This would echo many hunter-gatherer cultures with strong associations between women as hide-working artisans, making things just as crucial to survival as stone tools. Neanderthal ideas of gender probably drew on many things and didn't map precisely onto Western concepts of femininity. But it's an intriguing possibility that hide working and clothing itself might have been one point at which their material culture intersected with social identity. Synthesizing all the evidence for Neanderthal aesthetics and symbolic concepts results in an impressive corpus. But perhaps one of the most important results of the past three decades is that this burgeoning database makes it possible to discern conceptual commonalities between individual examples, as well as other aspects of their lives. Pigment is found with shells more than once. It's also incised with lines, as are bones and stones. And it's mixed with other substances to make something new, just as hafting adhesives were cooked or made up from recipes of pine resin and beeswax. In some places, other unusual things were happening. At Les Predelles, not only was bone engraved with lines and notches, but this material was also used for large numbers of retouches and even directly napped. And in the same layer as the raven bone at Saskalnia, Neanderthals were doing all that and also using red pigment, collecting wings and feet from large impressive birds, and even carrying tail bones of a dolphin all the way from the Black Sea. One thing remains, which is to ask how all of this compares to early Homo sapiens. Neanderthal pigment recipes echo a paint kit inside a shell at Blombos, South Africa, dating to 97 to 105,000 years ago. And the inclusion of sparkly pyrite is similar to shiny sheets of mica found with ochre at Majebebi, Australia, dating to 52 to 65,000 years ago. The Fomani ochred shell resembles finds from a number of early Homo sapiens sites, but Blombos is remarkable for having an assemblage of shell beads very likely strung together. Some Neanderthal engravings are clearly structured, but they're far from what was happening in another South African cave, Diepkloof. Earlier levels dating around 100,000 years ago contain simple linear engravings on ostrich eggshell fragments that are indistinguishable from those Neanderthals created on bone or pigment. But by 80,000 years ago, incised fragments with complex grids and bounded rows of lines appear and continue through multiple layers. In the roughly contemporary site of Blombos, there's also a famous piece of red ochre with a framed X-gridded pattern. So far, we have nothing from Neanderthals so strongly ordered, nor any graphic tradition visible across multiple pieces as at Diepkloof. What Neanderthals do have in common with early Homo sapiens prior to 45,000 years ago is an absence of any unequivocal representational art, manifested by carvings or breathtaking creatures running across stone ceilings. The oldest known image of an animal was painted before 44,000 years ago in Sulawesi, Indonesia. There are also handprints around the same age from Lubang Jerigi Sala, Borneo, and around 41,000 years ago, a tiny woman sculpted in ivory was left at Vergelhut, Germany. It's not clear whether these were independent artistic flowerings or if, like their southern African contemporaries, the populations dispersing into Eurasia before 80,000 years ago brought with them a common artistic tradition. And perhaps the roots go back even farther. The very oldest graphic engraving is a clear zigzag on the surface of a freshwater shell from Trinil, Java, made an astonishing 500,000 years ago. This raises the possibility that the Neanderthals and our ancient aesthetic heritage was a shared legacy from deep in the Homo lineage. We might have walked into a new continent and found it adorned by art, already many millennia old. The specific motivations behind Neanderthal aesthetics must remain unknowable. We might understand the primeval excitation of neurons by light, hue, and texture, or how skin and mind both are exhilarated by the rushing scream of a flock of swifts up into the sky. We might even reach for what feels like obvious metaphors, liquid red ochre as blood from the earth. But truly trying to glimpse Neanderthal minds is like seeing shafts of sun filtering into a cave, hazed by the dust motes of millennia. We must also forget classical ideas about art and appreciate that sometimes the significance and symbolism may have been in the act of transformation itself. Changing colour, marking surfaces, even taking feathers from a wing that flew, could have had meanings that resonated most during the process of creation. And this returns us to the enigma of Brunichel, a reminder that the tests we set for symbolic significance may well have had nothing to do with what was meaningful for Neanderthals. Monumental in scale and vision, it's the first great art project. And at the same time, truly weird, as in the original meaning of weird, destiny-changing power. Hominins might have made nothing like it for another 160,000 years, and the why behind those stacked circles of burned stalagmites is lost in darkness. But it marks a threshold in creative potential, and perhaps is even more unexpected than ochre paintings on cave walls. To our eyes today, it's both compelling and beautiful.